Yeah, we're continuing our series. We're looking at great Buddhist texts, as a lot of you know, and we're looking at the Pali Canon in this first bit of the year. So the Pali Canon being those discourses and commentaries and whatnot that were written down in the Pali language several hundred years after the Buddha's death, having been passed on as an oral tradition. Which get us about as close as we can get to the actual words of the Buddha. So that's what we've been looking at. And so far, we've spent quite a lot of time looking at Pali teachings on metta and friendship. If you like, teachings for the heart, which are almost certainly the most important teachings for us, given our cultural context, our cultural background. But the Pali Canon also contains a lot of teachings for the head, some of which are quite challenging. It contains some really radical concepts that can transform the way we see ourselves, transform the way we see our world. And these are important too, because to fly, as I used the analogy 2 weeks ago, to fly we need the two wings of positive emotion and wisdom, or as close as wisdom we can get, as we can get, which is perhaps right view. If we have one without the other, then a bit like a bird with one wing, we're likely to sort of do a lot of flapping around on the ground and going around in circles. So we need to cultivate them both. And the Tuesday before last, we looked at the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the discourse on the mark of non-selfhood, which is basically a meditation to deconstruct our sense of being a separate, independent self. To get us some idea of what this idea of anatman means, non-selfhood, which is one of the three marks of conditioned existence, according to the Dharma. And I made a big point at the time that that was quite a dangerous teaching. And I used the Sutta of the Water Snake as the text that we were using. In the Sutra of the Water Snake, it says if you grab this teaching, it gives this teaching, and then it says if you grab it wrong, it's like grabbing a water snake. Yeah, it will bite you. You have to grasp this bit of the Dharma particularly in the right way if you want to catch a water snake, for reasons that escaped me then and still escape me. But don't grab it by the tail, grab it by the back of the neck. And if you grab the teaching of Anatman wrong, it will bite you. It mustn't be misinterpreted nihilistically. It mustn't be taken to mean that we don't have free will. It mustn't be taken to mean that we don't have responsibility for our actions. It mustn't be taken to mean that we can't be expected to make an effort in the spiritual life. It mustn't be taken to mean that we don't need to develop a strong, functioning, integrated personality. It shouldn't be taken to mean that nothing about us could possibly survive death. And it certainly doesn't mean that we and other people don't matter, because we don't really exist. Okay? So those are all things that could come, all views that could come from a wrong understanding of Anatman, non-selfhood, and could be very damaging. We get bitten by the water snake. So what I said at the time was that it does mean that we're inextricably connected to others, that our sense of separateness is an illusion, that a way of life that just focuses on me and what I want will lead to suffering rather than fulfillment. So it points to a life of outrageous generosity, kindness to others, and great effort to become as much as we can for the sake of everybody and for the sake of the universe. So I made all those points 2 weeks ago. And today I'm going to introduce another concept, another big concept that lies behind this concept of anatman, this concept of non-selfhood, and which maybe even more obviously points to some conclusions about how we need to live. And this is the concept of what's called paticca-samuppada. That's the Pali, that's the Sanskrit. Usually translated as conditioned co-production, mutual co-arising, or interdependent origination, something like that. We're supposed to be gearing this to Great British Texts. To be honest, a bit of a fudge this week, because this teaching occurs in loads and loads of Buddhist texts. And I could have used the Great Discourse on Causes, but I've actually chose to call the text to sort of focus on something called the Discourse of the Sheaf of Reeds. Partly because it's really relevant to Sheffield, so we can have it as a sort of teaching for us. And partly because it really brings out something I think quite important about this teaching. But we'll get to that later. It brings out something quite fundamental about the teaching. There are loads and loads of teachings that talk about different aspects and the same aspect over and over again of conditioned co-production, but I've chosen that one, the Discourse on the Sheaf of Reeds. So Pratichit Samutpada. Praticha Samutpada or Pratichit Samutpada. I'm going to use mainly the Sanskrit because that's what we tend to do and I find it easy to pronounce. Conditioned co-production, mutual co-arising, interdependent origination. Maybe a good place to start would be by looking at the Pali word. So the Pali word, I made a bit of a mess of this. Upada means arising. Samupada means arising together. Sam is the same root as our same. So samupada, arising together. Paticca means something like on account of. So we could say it means on account of arising together, if that makes any sense. On account of arising together, which sort of seems to point to mutual co-arising as being the closest actual translation of the Pali. So on account of arising together. Whatever we call it, Pratichit Samutpada, conditioned co-production as we usually call it, is the fundamental conceptual or intellectual content of the Buddha's insight into the nature of reality. Okay? It's the big one. It's the fundamental concept of the Buddha's vision of reality. So, of course, the Buddha's insight goes beyond concepts. Just in the way that, say, the experience of being in India goes beyond anything that some statistics about India or a guidebook about India or a map of India could tell us. The experience is completely different from anything that can be said about it. So the Buddha's insight is inexpressible in words and concepts. But conditioned co-production, Pratichit Samutpada, is the main way he used concepts to express his vision for the sake of us who are not yet awakened, who still need concepts. So for the time being, until we wake up to reality ourselves, Pratichit Samutpada is going to be as close, an understanding of Pratichit Samutpada is going to be as close as we get. So getting an understanding of it is pretty vital to us. We mustn't think that when we understand it, or if we understand it, to the extent that we understand it intellectually, oh, I've now got the Buddha's insight. We mustn't think that. But we still need to try to understand it. Okay? It sounds really easy. It could seem like a simple idea, but it's nothing like it. It's not a simple idea at all. So at one point in the Pali Canon, Ananda, who is the Buddha's cousin and his companion for many years, says to the Buddha, he's talking about Pratichit Samutpada, conditioned co-production, and he says to the Buddha, "Wonderful, marvelous Lord, is this truth of conditioned co-production and how deep it appears. Yet I think it is very plain." And the Buddha replies, "Say not so, Ananda, say not so. Deep indeed is this condition co-production, hard to understand, serene, sublime, subtle, beyond logic, beyond the realm of words, intelligible only to the wise. It is through not understanding this conditioned co-production that humankind has become entangled like a ball of string, that mankind is blighted, unable to overpass the doom of the waste. It's big stuff. So deep indeed is this. You don't understand this, Anna. The deep indeed is this conditioned co-production. If you think it's plain, think again. Deep indeed is this conditioned co-production. Hard to understand, serene, sublime, subtle, beyond logic, beyond the realm of words, intelligible only to the wise. So it's deep, it's hard to understand in its fullness, it's subtle, it's beyond our usual thought processes and the language we use to express them. So Ananda thought he understood. And the Buddha says, if you think it's plain or obvious, think again. You haven't really understood it. And if Ananda couldn't understand it in its full depth, there's a pretty good chance we're going to struggle too. Yeah? So, you know, maybe don't expect too much out of me as well as anything else. So it can seem like a simple concept. But if we think we've understood it easily, we haven't started to understand its depth. If we think we already knew it before we came across the Dharma, as some people do say, then we've just got hold of some really simple little aspect of it. We haven't seen the whole thing. And if we think we've understood it and we don't go, wow, shock, horror, that just changes the way everything looks, then we haven't understood it. Okay? If it's just, oh yeah, okay, then we haven't understood it. If it doesn't go, we haven't understood it. If it doesn't make everything look different, then we haven't understood it in its depth. We might have understood quite a useful little implication of it, like all actions have consequences, or things change and come into existence according to conditions, but we haven't really understood Pratichasamutpada condition co-production. So it's often expressed by this formula. This being, that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. Now, some people really like this. I've got a real problem with this. Because I think this could give us the impression that we understand it. I think that we already know that things affect each other. That when one thing ceases to exist, other things that depended on it won't go out of existence. I think we already know that. I think we, if we've got a job, a reasonably well-paid job, I think we know that if our job ceases, our current affluent lifestyle ceases, and our possession of that expensive car we're still paying for ceases, and so on. I don't see how we could survive in the world without knowing that things depend on the conditions that keep them in existence. So I don't think we can possibly think that. That doesn't seem to me to be sublime, subtle, beyond the realm of terms, intelligible only to the wise. So I think we have to take this. We mustn't think this is just sums up what conditioned co-production means. I think this is an implication. I think we need to see these lines as a sort of poetic invocation of conditioned co-production, and not a sort of attempt to really explain it. It sort of evokes it. It sort of evokes it as like poetry. So where are we going to start? I think the best short definition I have come across that's likely to mean something to a modern Westerner comes from an American academic called Joanna Macy. And Joanna Macy wrote a book called Mutual Causality in Buddhism and General System Theory, The Dharma of Natural Systems, which is quite good, actually, if you're into that sort of thing. But she comes up on the first page with a definition of conditioned co-production, which I think might get us started. So she says, it's a vision of reality in which the existence of both the self and the world are seen in terms of mutually conditioning psychophysical events which arise and pass away interdependently. That's a pretty dense definition, okay? I think we have to look at the words of that a bit. A vision of reality in which the existence of both the self and the world are seen in terms of mutually conditioning psychophysical events which arise and pass away interdependently. So, maybe we need to look at it in a bit more detail. For a start, she says, it's a vision of reality. So, although it's expressed as a rational concept, it is an attempt to say something about a vision of reality, about the Buddha's vision of reality, which is very different from the way we see reality. Yeah? Wouldn't be worth having if it wasn't different from the way we see it. So it's an attempt to express a vision of reality. So it's a vision of reality in which the existence of both the self and the world. So it involves both the inner self and the outer world. So in the conditioned co-production vision, I have to translate, I've written, throughout my notes, I've abbreviated conditioned co-production to co-co-prod. So if I come out with co-co-prod, you know what I mean. In the co-co-prod vision, so in the conditioned co-production vision, our state of being and the world we experience mutually condition one another. Our inner state and the outer, apparently outer experience, mutually condition each other. Our inner world and the outer world co-create each other. So, the existence of both the self and the world are seen in terms of mutually conditioning. So, mutually conditioning, which is not the same as causing, okay? Causing is a one-way street. A billiard ball bumps into another, it causes it to go off in a particular direction. Something happens and it causes something else. That's not what we're talking about. That is actually just a rather unusual and very special case of conditioned co-production when one thing actually does cause another. So things are mutually conditioning. So we looked at the inner world and the outer world mutually condition. It's not the case that one causes the other. So it's not the case that matter in the form of brain, the outer world, or the material world in the form of a brain, causes the mind, which is the current superstition. But nor is it the case that the mind causes the outer world. The two mutually co-create, mutually co-condition. And so it's self and the world are seen in terms of mutually conditioning psychophysical events. Psychophysical events. Makes it even clearer that the conditioned co-production vision, in the conditioned co-production vision, it's not the case that the outer physical world of matter creates the inner world of mind, or vice versa. The self and the world, the inner world and the outer world of matter mutually condition. It's psychophysical. It involves both the inner and the outer. The self and the world, the inner world of mind and the outer world of matter mutually condition each other, and phenomena arise within that continuum and pass away interdependently. Interdependently, depending on each other. Okay, so it's quite a complex definition. A vision of reality in which the existence of both the self and the world are seen in terms of mutually conditioning psychophysical events which arise and pass away interdependently. So that's a sort of preliminary attempt to map out a little ground that we might sort of know where we're going. And maybe that definition from Joanna Macy can help us. So I'm going to try and explore conditioned co-production in a bit of a general way, as a sort of way of looking at the universe and ourselves. But I'm going to do that in a bit more detail later. But first, I need to talk a little bit more about the way the Buddha used this idea. The Buddha did not predominantly present this as a sort of philosophical idea. He presented it as a useful idea, something that could help us to grow. There are some suttas. I've been searching through the suttas quite a lot about this. There are some suttas where he really brings out the implications for the way things exist. And this became a huge aspect in later Buddhism, in Mahayana Buddhism. This, how do things really exist? So he did do that. And I think everything the Mahayana says about it, you can find in the Pali Canon. But on the whole, the Buddha used the concept of conditioned co-production quite practically. So he used it in the psycho-spiritual area. He applied it to karma and its results, our actions and their results. So he used conditioned co-production to show how actions of body, speech and mind affect us and the world we experience. He used it to show that the way we act now conditions the person we will become in the future and the world we will experience in the future. And that, of course, will then condition, that will become the past, that future will become the past, as it were, and continue to condition the way we are. So this is the famous wheel of life, which I've tried to sort of present here. So he used this 12 nidanas. He used the formula of the 12 nidanas, the 12 links, that's what it means, to describe how the past, which is both the self and the world, can determine the present, our responses in the present, and how the way we act in the present creates the future, which of course becomes the past. And you'll notice that there's a horrible circularity about this. This is the famous wheel of life. If we allow this to operate, there's no way out. The past, our present actions are determined by our past, and they create the future. And then we make us the sort of person we're going to become, and then we behave on the basis of that. This is the famous wheel of life. And we can go round and round it. Just do it. If we just do what feels good, do what's normal for us, do what avoids discomfort, this is a closed loop. We just go round and round, sort of perpetuating our tendencies, probably deepening our patterns, getting more and more sort of stuck in a rut, and then we die, and then we do it again. An endless cycle with no way out, the wheel of life. But there's a way out. Because there's also, he talked about these 12 negative nidanas, the way the psychophysical process can just go round and round and round and round and round. But he also in another sutta, the lost the name of it sutta, teaches about 12 positive nidanas. He says, well, we can break out of that loop. We can break out of that loop. Crucially, it's about facing up to discomfort, dukkha. If we respond to dukkha in our normal discomfort in our normal way, by distracting ourselves from it or by blaming others for it, then we keep going around. But if we face up to it and do something different, we can break out. We can get onto this 12 positive nirdhanas chain, and something different can start to happen. So we use this image of the wheel going round and round and round, and then the spiral. And we can get off the wheel and onto the spiral. A really simplistic, practical level, we could say, well, okay, so you're feeling bored and disgruntled after work. That's dukkha, discontent. You can, what can we do? We can distract ourselves from it with a bit of craving. Let's have a beer, let's have a cake, let's put the telly on. That seems the easy way. It sort of seems to distract us from it, but it just keeps the same old patterns operating. Or we could meditate, or go for a walk. That seems difficult. I'm disgruntled. That doesn't immediately distract us from our painful state. In fact, it probably makes us more aware of our painful state. So it's not what we immediately want to do. But if we do it, if we face the discomfort of doing something different, something new, it sets up a new dynamic. It sets up a new situation. We begin to set up new patterns. And if we keep making that sort of creative choice, it completely changes us. We get onto a sort of virtuous, off the vicious circle and onto a virtuous spiral, and things, our mental states can get better and better. So this is just basic Buddhism. This is just absolutely basic Buddhism. Maybe we don't know that nidana chain of the 12 nidanas or the 12 positive nidanas in any detail, and I'm not going to describe it in detail tonight because it's a whole talk or a course in itself. But this is just basic Buddhism. We talk a lot about this. We introduce it in beginners classes, and I think week two or week three, I'm not sure which. Week three, is it? week two. We talk about staying in the gap, not just responding automatically to Vedana, to what feels good or uncomfortable, facing the discomfort in a way that lets us act creatively and make changes. And that if we act creatively, we can set up new dynamics, we can change things. So this is basic Buddhism. And this is an application of Pratichasamutpada. And this is the most important application of Pratichasamutpada for us. It's completely basic Buddhism. Being in the gap, making the effort to get off the wheel and set up the vicious circle of the wheel and get onto the spiral. So that's really basic stuff. It's probably the most important thing about Pratichasamutpada, and I'm not going to talk about it. because we do it a lot, actually. We do it a lot. And this is really just one application. It's really just one application of Pratichasamutpada. One way that this conditioned co-production can operate. And I think we're supposed to be talking about wisdom teaching, so I'm going to sort of just try, into my limited ability, to sort of explore a deeper understanding of the basic principle behind the nidana chains. Because I think that can also help us to practice and grow. So that's what I'd like to explore for the rest of this talk. So I'm going to explore the general meaning of Pratichasamutpada. Getting some sort of intellectual understanding of Pratichasamutpada will change the way we see the world. And changing the way we see the world will change the way we live. And changing the way we live will change the world we live in. And incidentally, in case you hadn't noticed, this is Pratichasamutpada at work. This is another application of Pratichasamutpada. Yeah. Change something, other things change. When one thing changes, everything changes. So just as a sort of kick off this exploration, trying to explore Pratichasamutpada in a bit more detail, I'm going to offer three different levels of possible understanding. I have to say, I don't know that I understand this, so, you know, take it as, you know, I don't know, might be talking complete rubbish. But I'm going to offer three potential levels of understanding it. And the first one is the farmer level, the level of the farmer. Okay, so conditioned co-production. Things are part of mutually conditioning each other in this process. The farmer, how does a farmer understand that? So this sort of understanding emphasizes that for something to exist, the necessary conditions for it must be in place. Okay? This being, that becomes. This not being, that does not become. Everything depends on conditions. Now, every farmer knows this. Every farmer at the Buddha's time must have known this, or they're all starved to death. A good crop depends on conditions. Okay? Plowing the field. If you don't plow the field, no crop. Planting the seed. Don't plant the seed, no crop. Putting the right amount of manure on at the right time. Not much manure, mingy crop. Too much manure, dead crop. Right amount of manure. These the farmer can control. But then there have to be other conditions. There has to be the right amount of rain at the right time. When the seed's germinating, you need the rain, and then you need the rain to let it grow, and then you don't need a great thunderstorm just before you want to harvest it. You need the right amount of rain. You need the right temperature so it doesn't get frosted too early in the spring, too late when it's already developed. You need the right amount of sunshine. You need sort of to avoid unexpected conditions like an onset of an epidemic of potato blight. And if all those conditions come together, then you get a healthy crop. A good crop will arise. So this being, those conditions being, a healthy crop will arise. A healthy bank balance will arise. You can keep your daughter in university and still give your son that car. And lo and behold, yeah? So a farmer is going to understand this level of condition co-production. Everything depends on conditions. If we want something to arise, we have to set up the conditions to make it arise. If we want something to cease, then we need to think about the conditions that keep it in existence. And this is a really important level. It's probably, from what the stuff I'm talking about, it's probably the most important level that we need to think about. It might not be the philosophically sort of scintillating one, but it's the important one. We can really learn things from the spiritual life like this. Like, if we want to change, if we want to change ourselves, the easy way to do this is to change our conditions. Yeah? It's really difficult to change if all our conditions stay the same. If we keep all the circumstances of our outer life the same, the same people, the same routines, everything's the same, it's really difficult for us to change, actually. Whereas if we sort of put ourselves in a completely new environment, it's really easy to change. So that's why we emphasize things like sangha. That's a condition. Friendship with other people who are practicing is a condition we need to grow. We emphasize retreats where we put ourselves in different conditions. We emphasize communities where people are in supportive conditions for the Dharma. We emphasize right livelihood businesses where people can change their work conditions and that will help them to change. So all of those things are outcomes, if you like, of this farmer level of understanding. We need to set up the conditions for the spiritual life, for our own sort of positive change, if we want that to happen. That's the easy way to do it. The hard way to do it is to do it without trying to change our conditions. So we can apply this to meditation. Usually, if we want to improve our meditation, what we don't need is a clever technique. Usually what we need is to change the conditions of our life that determine our sort of habitual mental states. So if we can't meditate, it's much more likely to do with the fact that we're overly busy, that we have far too much input from the TV and computers and whatever, newspapers, radio, that we don't exercise enough, that we don't sort of keep our inspiration up, we don't keep our friendships with others up, our ethics leave something to be desired in various areas, we go to bed too late every night. All those things are much more likely to be why that we can't meditate than lacking that magical holy grail of a technique which doesn't exist. There is no technique that will help you to meditate, that will allow you to meditate if you haven't set up the conditions. So those are sort of implications of the farmer level, if you like. The farmer level of understanding of conditioned co-production. All these conditions come together and they co-produce change in us, or they don't. Yeah? If we want to improve our meditation, we set up the conditions which co-produce that. So that's the first level, the farmer level. I'm going to call the second one the ecologist level. And I'm going to call it that partly because I studied ecology, among other things, when I was at college. And when you study ecology, they teach you that ecological systems are governed by an incredibly complex web of conditions. Everything just interacts with everything else in an ecological system. So that there's this huge network of causal connections that are too complex for anyone to really analyze completely. So if you change everything changes. Yeah, you go and kill a load of bunny rabbits, and all your birds of prey die out because they live on them, or they all start eating mice instead, and then all the mice go, and then you haven't grazed the ground, so the grass gets really long, so all the flowers that used to live in the grass die, and you get thorny shrubs instead. And 10 years later, instead of having one sort of area of land, you've got a completely different one, and then people come along and say, that's really ugly, let's build a motorway through it. So, you know, one thing just leads to another, basically. Everything changes. So that's the ecological level of understanding, if you like. Everything affects everything else through these networks of causal connection, incredibly complex. And this is a really useful way to understand things. It's a more real way of understanding the world than thinking it's sort of about billiard balls, you know, causation, billiard balls that bump into each other. It can give us, it can be useful spiritually as well. It can help us to understand how interconnected we are with others, how much we depend on others, how much we owe to others. So if we start to reflect about our morning bowl of cereal, our morning bowl of cereal could not have existed without, well, what? The soil, the air, the rain, so the oceans, the atmosphere, the sun, and then, well, the farmer, the people who educated the farmer, the food the farmer eats, the food all those other people ate, the people who built the farmer's tractor, the bank that lent him the money to buy the tractor, the economic system that allows the bank to exist so that he can buy his tractor, the people who deposited the money in the bank that they lent to the farmer so that he could... all the food they eat, all their mums and dads, and all the food they eat, and pretty soon, everything. You start with anything in the universe, you end up drawing lines to everything. Huh? And if we can really take that on board, well, it just does erode at an intellectual level our sense of ourselves as sort of separate from everybody else, really. We sort of see just absolutely how much we owe to everybody else. And I think it opens up gratitude. I think it can open up gratitude to see that, oh, we're, you know, this rugged individual stuff's a load of rubbish. Yeah, it's just, it's, you know, we all depend so much on others. They've formed us, they nurture us, they keep us in existence. And that doesn't, it's not just people either, it's sort of like the whole, all ecosystems and all sorts of other things. The whole universe, in effect, keeps us in existence. So that's a sort of ecologist level of understanding. Then I've come up with, this starts to get a bit difficult after this, I've come up with another level, which I'm going to call the philosopher's level of understanding. I couldn't quite decide what to call it. I thought I might call it the wisdom level. I thought that's really pretentious for Daniel, because that sort of implies you've got some. And philosophy's not right either, but I'm going to call it the philosopher's level. It's the philosopher's level. And there's a couple of things I think mainly distinguish this level from the level of the, say, the ecologist or the farmer. So at the level of the ecologist or farmer, we could still be thinking about the world as composed of these separate things that are connected, that affect each other in all sorts of complex ways. It's still separate things, separate phenomena that have an effect on each other. Really complex effects, but they're still separate. But at the philosopher's level, really, it's not that reality consists of things that are linked by complex chains of causation. At this level, we see there aren't any really separate things to affect each other. There is just conditioned co-production. There is just the process of conditioned co-production in which all phenomena co-arise. They all mutually arise and mutually condition each other. All phenomena depend for their very existence on the existence of everything else. Any idea that there are truly separate phenomena or separate things that are somehow different from this process is an illusion. Okay. So at the philosopher's level, an understanding of praticcittasamutpada, conditioned co-production, starts to change the way in which we think things exist. We see that phenomena that we think of as separate entities, like ourselves, for example, could no more exist separately and apart from everything else than, say, an eddy in a stream could exist separately from the stream. There's an eddy, it's got a certain sort of existence. But really that eddy is just a conventional designation for a phenomenon happening within the stream. Not really a separate thing. And we are just a conventional designation for phenomena happening within the ever-changing stream of conditioned co-production, the ever-changing stream of psychophysical effects. We don't have any more separate existence than the eddy from conditioned co-production than the eddy does from the stream. So conditioned co-production implies this concept of non-selfhood that we talked about 2 weeks ago. They're two different sides of the same coin. So that analogy of the river, there's another analogy that's sometimes used, which is the analogy of a rainbow. So analogy of a rainbow. A rainbow isn't a thing in itself, okay? It comes into existence when a certain sort of complex of conditions come into existence. So you need some rain. You need some rain. And then you need some sun. And then you need an observer in a particular place. If the rainbow depends just as crucially on the observer as it does on the sun and the rain. So to an observer in a different place, there's no rainbow. Or there's a different rainbow. So the rainbow doesn't exist of itself as a separate thing. It exists, but not in that way. It exists because some conditions have come together. And if we think it exists in the wrong way, we start asking absurd questions, like, where does it end? Where's the pot of gold that I can find? Yeah? And if we think that we exist in the wrong way, as things in ourselves, we also start, or other things in the universe, we also start to ask these absurd questions. So, in a number of suttas, people come to the Buddha and ask him absurd questions. They ask him, is the body the same as the mind? Or does the body cause the mind? And the Buddha gives his routine answer. It's not the case that the body is the same as the mind. It's not the case that the body is different from the mind. It's not the case that the body is both the same and different from the mind. And it's not the case that the body is neither different nor the same as the mind. What the Buddha is saying is, that's a silly question. That's like asking, where does the rainbow end? And somebody comes to the Buddha and they ask, is the universe one whole thing, one thing? Is it a oneness or is it a manyness? And he says, well, it wouldn't be true to say that the universe is a oneness. And it wouldn't be true to say that the universe is a manyness. And it wouldn't be true to say, etc., etc., etc. Actually, he doesn't say that. He says they're stupid for a different reason. I've got that a bit wrong. Anyway, he says it's not true. It's not true that there are oneness, and it's not true that there are manyness. That's a silly question. Think of praticcittasamutpada, conditioned co-production. It's not a oneness, and it's not a manyness. It's got features of both. So that's one thing, if you like, that distinguishes maybe what we might call the philosopher's level from the ecologist and the farmers. It's not that there are loads of different things that affect each other. There aren't any things. Yeah? There's just conditioned co-production. And the second aspect that maybe distinguishes the philosopher's level from the ecologist's has maybe got to do with, well, it might have to do with something to do with the difference in feeling between the term mutual co-arising and conditioned co-production. Mutual co-arising, as we've seen, is perhaps a more accurate translation of the Pali. And it might also have something to do with the fact that we're talking about psychophysical events here as well. The trouble with the ecologist or the farmer's level is we could think it was all just about the material world, material conditionality. So this is a good point at which I can mention. So bringing this out is a good point at which I can mention. Yay, the discourse of the sheaves. You may have noticed that it's 25 past 8 and I haven't mentioned it yet. This is actually a discussion between Sariputra and a monk called Mahagotita. And they're talking about the 12 Nidanas. They're talking about conditioned co-production. And the monk is puzzled. Mahagotita, he's puzzled, and I don't blame him. He's obviously thinking in terms of causality. He's thinking of conditioned co-production in terms of causality. And his question in the Pali, as it's translated, is not entirely clear. But he obviously wants to know what causes what. So what causes what in this chain? Does consciousness fundamentally exist and then give rise to physical form? Or does physical form fundamentally exist and then give rise to consciousness? And so on with the other links in the chain. And Sariputra, who's the sort of the teacher in this, says, well, I can see why you might find that a bit puzzling. But to help you understand, I'll use an analogy. Think about a sheaf of reeds. So a sheaf of reeds is made by leaning bundles of reeds up against each other so that they can dry out. We used to do that in this country with bundles of corn to help them dry out. We'd make sheaves in the fields by leaning bundles up against each other. So, as I said, this is a very apt analogy for a talk in Sheffield. So, Sariputra sort of talks about this, and he says, well, in what way do the different bundles of reeds in a sheaf condition each other and make up the sheaf? It's not that any one of them causes any one of the others to stand up and form a sheaf. The existence of the sheaf depends on all of them mutually supporting each other. If you take away any bundle, the whole thing collapses. No sheaf. In just the same way, consciousness, form, and all the other links in the chain of the Nidana chain of conditioned co-production are essential parts of the reality we experience. You take any of them away, and you can't take any of them away and still have a reality. This analogy actually falls down because you can take one of the sheaves away and then the thing collapses. You just can't take anything out of reality. You can't abstract one of these things out of reality. You can take a sheaf out. Reality is an interconnected whole. So another analogy that's often used in later Buddhism for this is the dream. So the argument goes, we and everything else are like something or someone that appears in a dream. A chair in a dream can't exist independently of the reality of the dream. You can't cut it out and put it in your living room. Everything in a dream mutually co-arises. They are mutually co-arising aspects of the dream reality. Just like a dream elephant can't exist outside of the dream, we can't exist separately from the reality that we are a part of. You can't cut us out and put us in heaven. Poof. The way we are now is an aspect of this particular reality. It's built in. So this dream analogy is maybe a better one than the river one or the rainbow one, or even the sheaf of reeds, because it links mind and the things that appear to mind. The other analogies can be interpreted materialistically, whereas the dream one makes it clear that we're talking about a system of a stream of psychophysical events, not just material causality. few. So that's an attempt to explore some of the possible meanings and implications of conditioned co-production. I'm sure there'll be a lot of questions about that. And if we get anywhere near getting a glimpse of understanding that, it should be incredibly threatening, right, to our ego, because it's threatening to egos. But actually, if we understand it properly, the teaching is actually very, very positive. So I'm going to round off with some of the positive aspects of the teaching. One aspect of the teaching is that we are part of everything. We are interlinked with everything. We're inextricably bound up with everything and everybody. We are not a lonely, separate, hard lump of egotistical misery at war with the world, which is somehow how it feels, sometimes how it feels. So we're linked, we're part of everything, but at the same time, we don't have to give up our individuality. It's not the case that all is one, just one big sort of rice pudding that we have to merge into. As the Buddha points out in a sutta called the Lokayatika Sutta, it's not true to say that the universe is one. It's not true to say it's many. Pratichit Samutpada is neither one nor many, or something in between. So the Buddha, what the Buddha actually says about this is, he says, avoiding these two extremes, one and many, the Buddha teaches the Dharma as the middle way. So that's one of the aspects, that the Dharma is a middle way. It's the middle way between, oh, it's all one man, and we're all these separate little individuals cut off from each other. No, we're actually all related. We exist in an intimate relationship. We have a certain level of individuality, but we exist in an intimate relationship to everything and everybody else. We are both joined and we're unique and distinct. We exist in relationship, which is actually far more fun than merging into rice pudding or being sort of separate billiard balls. So that's one implication. It's back to you. Another one is that we can change infinitely. This conditioned co-production gives rise to infinite possibilities. This process of psychophysical change means that given time, we could become anything. And the outer world could be transformed as well. Another thing, another really positive thing about it is it does away with the extreme view of materialism. So materialism is the view that matter is what actually fundamentally exists, and that things like mind are just a sort of accidental production of matter that don't have the same level of reality. And that is the prevailing superstition of our age, that matter is what's real, and that mind is somehow less real. And this traps us in a very grey, limited world of very few spiritual possibilities. So in the Pratichit Samutpada, the conditioned co-production vision, the world isn't limited in that way to a narrow materialism. It isn't limited in the way that would lead us to believe. Mind and matter are equal, mutually conditioning parts of reality. It's not like one's true and the other's not. They're mutually conditioning parts of reality. So, maybe what we might think of as miracles are possible. Mind is part of reality. If a bodhisattva appears to us in meditation, that is certainly as real as what we had for dinner. In fact, it's much more real than what we had for dinner. The reality that we are in a relationship with can communicate with us in all sorts of ways. Maybe it can appear to us in our minds, in any form it jolly well pleases, including in meditation. So, Pratichit Samutpada makes the world much more interesting, because it does away with this grey materialism, which reduces life to something very boring. Also does away with the extreme view of eternalism, the opposite view, that everything sort of, there's somehow some sort of principle behind everything which never changes, which actually is equally boring. But less of a problem for most of us, I think, because it's not the prevailing ethos. And then last, the last thing I think that Pratichit Samutpada says is that we are incredibly important. We are not just a meaningless bit of blob, a population statistic. We don't exist in the way that we normally think we exist. We don't exist as static, independent entities, but we certainly do exist. And that existence is immensely important because the way we are, us, we interpenetrate with the whole world. In a way, we affect the whole world. The way we are affects the whole world, affects everything. We co-arise with everything. We mingle and interpenetrate with everything and everyone. We affect everything and everyone. There's a saying in Zen Buddhism that when an enlightened being arises, all the grass becomes greener and the flowers look brighter. Well, why not? The whole world is affected because we're inextricably linked to the whole world. And the world of matter is inextricably linked to the world of mind. They're two aspects, two sides of the same coin. The two arise together. They can't be separated. Get enlightened, you make the grass greener. So those are some positives that arise from this. Now, we saw in the Sutta of the Water Snake 2 weeks ago that we mustn't grab the idea of Anatman the wrong way. And the idea of Anatman is really just a part of conditioned co-production. So as with Anatman, we mustn't see it in nihilistic terms. We mustn't think that it means that we don't matter, that other people don't matter, that ethics don't matter, that there's no such thing as responsibility because I'm sort of part of everything. Mustn't think that it means we don't have the ability to make choices because we're linked to everything. We must think. We mustn't think that how we are and how we live doesn't matter. We do matter. How we live matters. Other people matter. We have choices, and the karmic effects of those choices matter immensely to us and others. Because conditioned co-production and the idea of non-selfhood don't mean that we don't exist. What conditioned co-production really means is that we exist in a much more wonderful and mysterious and magical and related way than we ever imagined.